strange thing, and because generosity deserved generosity in return, but mostly because it felt like the right thing to do. And that is reason enough.
4 days. 6 days if raining.
Rowant was the third wagoneer I'd asked about going north to Imre, the town nearest the university. He was a thick-bodied Kildish man with a fierce black beard that hid most of his face. He turned away and barked curses in Siaru at a man loading a wagon with bolts of cloth. When he spoke his native language, he sounded like an angry rock slide. His rough voice lowered to a rumble as he turned back to me.
2 coppers, George, not pennies. You can ride in a wagon if there is space. You can sleep underneath at night if you want. You eat in the evening with us. Lunch is just bread. If a wagon gets stuck, you help push.
There was another pause while he shouted at the men. There were 3 wagons being packed with trade goods while the 4th was achingly familiar, one of the wheeled houses I had spent most of my early life riding. Rowan's wife, Rita, sat in the front of that wagon. Her mien wavered from severe when she watched the men loading the wagons to smiling when she spoke with a girl standing nearby. I assumed the girl was a passenger like myself. She was my age, perhaps a year older, but a year makes a great deal of difference at that time of life. The Tal have a saying about children of our age: the boy grows upward, but the girl grows up. She was dressed practically for traveling, pants and shirt, and was just young enough for it not to seem improper. Her bearing was such that if she had been a year older, I would have been forced to see her as a lady. As it was, when she spoke with Rita, she moved back and forth between a genteel grace and a childlike exuberance. She had long, dark hair and, simply said, she was beautiful. It had been a long time since I had seen anything beautiful. Rowant followed my gaze and continued.
Everyone helps set camp at night. Everyone takes a turn watching. You fall asleep during your watch, you get left behind. You eat with us, whatever my wife cooks. You complain, you get left behind. You walk too slow, you get left behind. You bother the girl.
He ran a hand through his thick, dark beard.
Bad things happen.
Hoping to turn his thoughts in a different direction, I spoke up. When will the wagons be done loading?
2 hours,
he said with a grim certainty, as if defying the workers to contradict him. One of the men stood upright atop a wagon, shading his eyes with a hand. He called out, raising his voice over the sound of horses, wagons, and men that filled the square.
Don't let him scare you off, kid. He's decent enough after all the growling.
Rowant pointed a stern finger and the man turned back to his work. I hardly needed to be convinced. A man who travels with his wife is usually to be trusted. Besides, the price was fair, and he was leaving today. I took this opportunity to pull a pair of jots from my purse and hold them out to Rowant. He turned to me.
2 hours.
He held up thick fingers to make his point.
You're late. You get left behind.
I nodded solemnly.
Ryusa tu kialus aisha tua.
Thank you for bringing me close to your family. Rowan's great shaggy eyebrows went up. He recovered quickly and gave a quick nod that was almost a small bow. I looked around the square, trying to get my bearings.
Someone's full of surprises.
I turned around to see the worker who had shouted to me from the wagon. He held out his hand.
Derek!
I shook his hand, feeling awkward. It had been so long since I'd made simple conversation with someone that I felt strange and hesitant.
Quoth.
Derek put his hands behind him and stretched his back with a grimace. He stood head and shoulders taller than me, 20 or so, tall and blonde.
You gave Rowan a bit of a turn there. Where'd you learn to speak Siaru?
An arcanist taught me a little, I explained. I watched as Rowan went to speak to his wife. The dark-haired girl looked in my direction and smiled. I looked away, not knowing what to make of it. He shrugged.
I'll leave you to fetch your things, then. Rowan's all growl and not much gruff, but he won't wait once the wagons are packed.
I nodded, even though my things were non-existent. I did have a little shopping to do. They say you can find anything in Tarbin, if you have enough money. For the most part, they're right. I made my way down the stairs to Trappus's basement. It felt strange to make the trip wearing shoes. I was used to the cool damp of stone underfoot when I came to pay a visit. As I made my way down the short hallway, a boy in rags emerged from the inner rooms holding a small winter apple. He pulled up short when he saw me, then scowled, his eyes narrow and suspicious. Looking down, he brushed roughly past me. Without even thinking about it, I snapped his hand away from my purse and turned to look at him, too stunned for words. He bolted outside, leaving me confused and disturbed. We never stole from each other here. Out on the streets it was everyone for themselves, but Trappus's basement was the closest thing to a sanctuary we had, like a church. None of us would risk spoiling that. I took the last few steps into the main room and was relieved to see that everything else seemed normal. Trappus wasn't there, probably off collecting charity to help him care for his children. There were 6 cots all full and more children lying on the floor. Several grubby urchins stood around a bushel basket on the table, clutching winter apples. They turned to stare at me, their expressions flinty and spiteful. It dawned on me then. None of them recognized me. Clean and well-dressed, I looked like some regular boy come wandering in. I didn't belong. Just then, Trappus came back, carrying several flat loaves of bread under one arm and a squalling child in the other.
Ari!
He called to one of the boys standing near the bushel basket.
Come help! We've got a new visitor and she needs changing!
The boy hurried over and took the child out of Trappus's arms. He lay the bread on the table next to the bushel basket, and all the children's eyes fixed on him attentively. My stomach went sour. Trappus hadn't even looked at me. What if he didn't recognize me? What if he told me to leave? I didn't know if I could cope with that. I began to edge toward the door. Trappus pointed to the children one at a time.
Let me see, David. You empty and scrub the drinking barrel. Let's get in brackish. When he's done, Nathan can fill it from the pump.
Can I take twice?
Nathan asked.
I need some for my brother.
Your brother can come for his own bread,
Trappus said gently, then looked more closely at the boy, sensing something.
Is he hurt?
Nathan nodded, looking at the floor. Trappus laid a hand on the boy's shoulder.
Bring him down. We'll see to him.
It's his leg,
Nathan blurted, seeming close to tears.
It's all hot, and he can't walk.
Trappus nodded and gestured to the next child.
Jen, you help Nathan bring his brother back.
They hurried out.
Tam, since Nathan's gone, you carry the water instead. Quoth, you run for soap.
He held out a halfpenny.
Go to Mana's in the wash. You'll get better from her if you tell her who it's for.
I felt a sudden lump form in my throat. He knew me. I can't hope to explain to you how much of a relief it was. Trappus was the closest thing I had to family. The thought of him not knowing me had been horrifying.
I don't have time to run an errand, Trappus, I said hesitantly. I'm leaving. I'm heading inland to Imre.
Are you then?
He asked, then paused and gave me a second closer look.
Well then, I guess you are.
Of course. Trappus never saw the clothes, only the child inside them.
I stopped by to let you know where my things are. On the roof of the candleworks, there's a place where 3 roofs meet. There are some things there, a blanket, a bottle. I don't need any of it anymore. It's a good place to sleep if anyone needs one. Dry. No one goes there.
I trailed off.
That's kind of you. I'll send one of the boys round,
Trappus said.
Come here.
He came forward and gathered me into a clumsy hug, his beard tickling the side of my face.
I'm always glad to see one of you get away, he said softly to me. I know you'll do just fine for yourself, but you can always come back if you need to.
One of the girls on a nearby cot began to thrash and moan. Trappist pulled away from me and turned to look.
What?
He said as he hurried over to tend to her, his bare feet slapping on the floor.
What?
Hush, hush. Chapter 33 A Sea of Stars. I returned to Drover's lot with a travel sack swinging by one shoulder. It held a change of clothes, a loaf of trail bread, some jerked meat, a skin of water, needle and thread, flint and steel, pens and ink. In short, everything an intelligent person takes on a trip in the event they might need it. However, my proudest acquisition was a dark blue cloak that I had bought off a fripperer's cart for only 3 jots. It was warm, clean, and, unless I missed my guess, only one owner from new. Now let me say this. When you're travelling, a good cloak is worth more than all your other possessions put together. If you've nowhere to sleep, it can be your bed and blanket. It will keep the rain off your back and the sun from your eyes. You can conceal all manner of interesting weaponry beneath it if you're clever, and a smaller assortment if you are not. But beyond all that, 2 facts remain to recommend a cloak. First, very little is as striking as a well-worn cloak, billowing lightly about you in the breeze. And second, the best cloaks have innumerable little pockets that I have an irrational and overpowering attraction towards. As I've said, this was a good cloak, and it had a number of such pockets. Squirreled away in them, I had string and wax, some dried apple, a tinder box, a marble in a small leather sack, a pouch of salt, hook needle, and gut. I'd made a point of spending all my carefully hoarded Commonwealth coin, keeping my hard Caelish currency for my trip. Pennies spent well enough here in Tarbin, but Caelish money was solid no matter where in the four corners you found yourself. A final flurry of preparation was being made as I arrived. Rowant paced around the wagons like a restless animal, checking everything again and again. Rita watched the workers with a stern eye and a quick word for anything that wasn't being done to her satisfaction. I was comfortably ignored until we headed out of the city, towards the university. As the miles rolled away, it was as if a great weight slowly fell away from me. I reveled in the feel of the ground through my shoes, the taste of the air, the quiet hush of wind brushing through the spring wheat in the fields. I found myself grinning, for no good reason, save that I was happy. We, Rue, are not meant to stay in one place for so long. I took a deep breath and nearly laughed out loud. I kept to myself as we travelled, not being used to the company of others. Rowant and the mercenaries were willing to leave me alone. Derek joked with me off and on, but generally found me too reserved for his tastes. That left the other passenger, Denna. We didn't speak until the first day's ride was nearly done. I was riding with one of the mercenaries, absently peeling the bark from a willow switch. While my fingers worked, I studied the side of her face, admiring the line of her jaw, the curve of her neck into her shoulder. I wondered why she was traveling alone and where she was going. In the middle of my musing, she turned to look in my direction and caught me, staring at her.
Penny for your thought,
she asked, brushing at an errant strand of hair. I was wondering what you're doing here, I said half honestly. Smiling, she held my eyes.
Liar.
I used an old stage trick to keep myself from blushing, gave my best unconcerned shrug and looked down at the willow wand I was peeling. After a few minutes, I heard her return to her conversation with Rita. I found myself strangely disappointed. After camp was set and dinner was cooking, I idled around the wagons examining the knots Rowant used to lash his cargo into place. I heard a footfall behind me and turned to see Denner approaching. My stomach rolled over, and I took a short breath to compose myself. She stopped about a dozen feet from me.
Have you figured it out yet?
She asked.
Excuse me? Why I'm here?
She smiled gently.
I've been wondering the same thing for most of my life, you see. I thought, if you had any ideas...
She gave me a wry, hopeful look. I shook my head, too uncertain of the situation to find the humor in it. All I've been able to guess is that you're going somewhere. She nodded seriously.
That's as much as I've guessed, too.
She paused to look at the circle the horizon made around us. The wind caught her hair and she brushed it back again.
Do you happen to know where I'm going?
I felt a smile begin a slow creep onto my face. It felt odd. I was out of practice smiling.
Don't you know?
I have suspicions. Right now, I'm thinking Annalyn.
She rocked onto the edges of her feet, then back to the flat.
But I've been wrong before.
A silence settled over our conversation. Denner looked down at her hands, fidgeting with a ring on her finger, twisting it. I caught a glimpse of silver and a pale blue stone. Suddenly she dropped her hands to her sides and looked up at me.
Where are you going?
The university. She arched an eyebrow, looking 10 years older.
So certain?
She smiled and was suddenly young again.
How does it feel to know where you're going?
I couldn't think of a reply, but was saved from the need for one by Rita calling us for supper. Denner and I walked toward the campfire together. The beginning of the next day was spent in a brief, awkward courtship. Eager, but not wanting to seem eager, I made a slow dance around Denner before finally finding some excuse to spend time with her. Denner, on the other hand, seemed perfectly at ease. We spent the rest of the day as if we were old friends. We joked and told stories. I pointed out the different types of clouds and what they told of the weather to come. She showed me the shapes they held, a rose, a harp, a waterfall. So passed the day. Later, when lots were being drawn to see who had which turn at watch, Denner and I drew the first two shifts. Without discussing it, we shared the 4 hours of watch together. Talking softly so as not to wake the others, we sat close by the fire and spent the time watching very little but each other. The third day was much the same. We passed the time pleasantly, not in long conversation, but more often watching the scenery, saying whatever happened to come to our minds. That night we stopped at a wayside inn, where Rita bought fodder for the horses and a few other supplies. Rita retired early with her husband, telling each of us that she'd arranged for our dinners and beds with the innkeeper. The former was quite good, bacon and potato soup with fresh bread and butter. The latter was in the stables, but it was still a long sight better than what I was used to in Tarbeen. The common room smelled of smoke and sweat and spilled beer. I was glad when Denner asked if I wanted to take a walk. Outside was the warm quiet of a windless spring night. We talked as we wended our slow way through the wild bit of forest behind the inn. After a while, we came to a wide clearing circling a pond. On the edge of the water were a pair of waystones, their surfaces silver against the black of the sky, the black of the water. One stood upright, a finger pointing to the sky, the other lay flat, extending into the water like a short stone pier. No breath of wind disturbed the surface of the water. So as we climbed out onto the fallen stone, the stars reflected themselves in double fashion, as above, so below. It was as if we were sitting amid a sea of stars. We spoke for hours, late into the night. Neither of us mentioned our pasts. I sensed that there were things she would rather not talk about, and by the way she avoided questioning me, I think she guessed the same. We spoke of ourselves instead, of fond imaginings and impossible things. I pointed to the skies and told her the names of stars and constellations. She told me stories about them I had never heard before. My eyes were always returning to Denna. She sat beside me, arms hugging her knees. Her skin was more luminous than the moon, her eyes wider than the sky, deeper than the water, darker than the night. It slowly began to dawn on me that I had been staring at her, wordlessly, for an impossible amount of time. Lost in my thoughts, lost in the sight of her. But her face didn't look offended or amused, it almost looked as if she were studying the lines of my face, almost as if she were waiting. I wanted to take her hand. I wanted to brush her cheek with my fingertips. I wanted to tell her that she was the first beautiful thing I had seen in 3 years, that the sight of her yawning to the back of her hand was enough to drive the breath from me. How I sometimes lost the sense of her words in the sweet fluting of her voice. I wanted to say that if she were with me, then somehow nothing could ever be wrong for me again. In that breathless second, I almost asked her. I felt the question boiling up from my chest. I remember drawing a breath, then hesitating. What could I say? Come away with me? Stay with me? Come to the university? No. Sudden certainty tightened in my chest like a cold fist. What could I ask her? What could I offer? Nothing. Anything I said would sound foolish. A child's fantasy. I closed my mouth and looked across the water. Inches away, Denna did the same. I could feel the heat of her. She smelled like road dust and honey, and the smell the air holds seconds before a heavy summer rain. Neither of us spoke. I closed my eyes. The closeness of her was the sweetest, sharpest thing my life had ever known. Chapter 34. Yet to Learn. The next morning I blearily awoke after 2 hours of sleep, bundled myself onto one of the wagons and proceeded to drowse away the morning. It was nearly noon before I realized that we had taken on another passenger at the inn last night. His name was Jossen, and he had paid Rowant for passage to Annalyn. He had an easy manner and an honest smile. He seemed an earnest man. I did not like him. My reason was simple. He spent the entire day riding next to Denna. He flattered her outrageously and joked with her about becoming one of his wives. She seemed unaffected by the late hours we had kept the night before, looking as bright and fresh as ever. The result was that I spent the day being irritated and jealous while acting unconcerned. Since I was too proud to join their conversation, I was left to myself. I spent the day thinking sullen thoughts, trying to ignore the sound of his voice and occasionally remembering the way Denna had looked last night, with the moon reflecting off the water behind her. That night I was planning to ask Denna to go for a walk after everyone turned in for the night, but before I could approach her, Jossen went to one of the wagons and brought back a large black case with brass buckles along the side. The sight of it made my heart turn sideways in my chest. Sensing the group's anticipation, though not mine in particular, Jossen slowly undid the brass clasps and drew out his lute with an air of studied nonchalance. It was a trooper's lute. Its long, graceful neck and round bowl were painfully familiar. Sure of everyone's attention, he cocked his head and strummed, pausing to listen to the sound. Then, nodding to himself, he started to play. He had a fair tenor and reasonably clever fingers. He played a ballad, then a light, quick-drinking song, then a slow, sad melody in a language that I didn't recognize but suspected might be Ilish. Lastly, he played Tinker Tanner, and everyone came in on the chorus. Everyone but me. I sat still as stone, with my fingers aching. I wanted to play, not listen. Want isn't strong enough a word. I was hungry for it, starved. I'm not proud of the fact that I thought about stealing his loot and leaving in the dark of the night. He finished the song with a flourish, and Rowan clapped his hands a couple of times to get everyone's attention.
Time for sleep! You sleep too late!
Derek broke in, gently teasing.
We get left behind. We know Master Rowan will be ready to roll with the light.
Jocelyn laughed and flipped open his loot case with his foot. But before he could put it away, I called over to him. Could I see that for a second? I tried to keep the desperation out of my voice, tried to make it sound like idle curiosity. I hated myself for the question. Asking to hold a musician's instrument is roughly similar to asking to kiss a man's wife. Non-musicians don't understand. An instrument is like a companion and a lover. Strangers ask to touch and hold with annoying regularity. I knew better, but I couldn't help myself. Just for a second. I saw him stiffen slightly, reluctant. But keeping friendly appearances is a minstrel's business just as much as music. Certainly, he said with a jocularity that I saw as false, but was probably convincing for the others. He strode over to me and held it out. Be careful. Jocelyn took a couple of steps back and gave a very good appearance of being at ease, but I saw how he stood with his arms slightly bent, ready to rush forward and whisk the loot away from me if the need arose. I turned it over in my hands. Objectively, it was nothing special. My father would have rated it as one short step above firewood. I touched the wood. I cradled it against my chest. I spoke without looking up.
It's beautiful, I said softly, my voice rough with emotion.
It was beautiful. It was the most beautiful thing I had seen in 3 years. More beautiful than the sight of a spring field after 3 years of living in that pestilent cesspit of a city. More beautiful than Denna. Almost. I can honestly say that I was still not really myself. I was only 4 days away from living on the streets. I was not the same person I had been back in the days of the troop, but neither was I yet the person you hear about in stories. I had changed because of Tarbin. I had learned many things it would have been easier to live without. But sitting beside the fire, bending over the loot, I felt the hard, unpleasant parts of myself that I had gained in Tarbin crack. Like a clay mold around a now cool piece of iron, they fell away, leaving something clean and hard behind. I sounded the strings, one at a time. When I hit the third, it was ever so slightly off, and I gave one of the tuning pegs a minute adjustment without thinking.
Here now, don't go touching those.
Jocelyn tried to sound casual.
You'll turn it from true.
But I didn't really hear him. The singer and all the rest couldn't have been farther away from me if they'd been at the bottom of the Kenthi Sea. I touched the last string and tuned it to ever so slightly. I made a simple chord and strummed it. It rang soft and true. I moved a finger and the chord went minor in a way that always sounded to me as if the lute was saying, sad. I moved my hands again and the lute made two chords, whispering against each other. Then, without realizing what I was doing, I began to play. The strings felt strange against my fingers, like reunited friends who have forgotten what they have in common. I played soft and slow, sending notes no farther than the circle of our firelight. Fingers and strings made a careful conversation as if their dance described the lines of an infatuation. Then I felt something inside me break, and music began to
pour out into the quiet. My fingers danced. Intricate and quick, they spun something gossamer and tremulous into the circle of light our fire had made. The music moved like a spiderweb, stirred by a gentle breath. It changed like a leaf twisting as it falls to the ground. And it felt like 3 years waterside in Tarbin with a hollowness inside you and hands that ached from the bitter cold. I don't know how long I played. It could have been 10 minutes or an hour. But my hands weren't used to the strain. They slipped, and the music fell to pieces like a dream on waking. I looked up to see everyone perfectly motionless, their faces ranging from shock to amazement. Then, as if my gaze had broken some spell, everyone stirred. Rowant shifted in his seat. The two mercenaries turned and raised eyebrows at each other. Derek looked at me as if he had never seen me before. Rita remained frozen, her hand held in front of her mouth. Denna lowered her face into her hands and began to cry in quiet, hopeless sobs. Jossen simply stood. His face was stricken and bloodless, as if he had been stabbed. I held out the loot, not knowing whether to thank him or apologize. He took it numbly. After a moment, unable to think of anything to say, I left them sitting by the fire and walked toward the wagons. And that is how Quoth spent his last night before he came to the university, with his cloak as both his blanket and his bed. As he lay down, behind him was a circle of fire, and before him lay shadow, like a mantle gathered. His eyes were open, that much is certain. But who among us can say they know what he was seeing? Look behind him instead, to the circle of light that the fire has made, and leave Quoth to himself for now. Everyone deserves a moment or two alone when they desire it. And if by chance there were tears, let us forgive him. He was just a child, after all, and had yet to learn what sorrow really was. Chapter 35 A Parting of Ways. The weather held fair, which meant that the wagons rolled into Imre just as the sun was setting. My mood was sullen and hurt. Denna had shared a wagon with Jossen the whole of the day, and I, being foolish and proud, had kept my distance. A whirl of activity sprang up as soon as the wagons rolled to a stop. Rowant began to argue with a clean-shaven man in a velvet hat before he had brought his wagon to a full stop. After the initial bout of bargaining, a dozen men began unloading bolts of cloth, barrels of molasses, and burlap sacks of coffee. Rita cast a stern eye over the lot of them. Jossen scuttled around trying to keep his luggage from being damaged or stolen. My own luggage was easier to manage, as I only had my travel sack. I retrieved it from between some bolts of cloth and moved away from the wagons. I slung it over one shoulder and looked around for Denna. I found Rita instead.
"You were a great help on the road," she said clearly.
Her Aturan was much better than Rowan's, with hardly any trace of a Siaru accent at all.
"It is nice to have someone along who can unhitch a horse without being led by the hand."
She held out a coin to me. I took it without thinking. It was a reflex action from my years as a beggar, like the reverse of jerking your hand back from a fire. Only after the coin was in my hand did I take a closer look at it. It was a whole copper jot, fully half of what I had paid to travel with them to Imre. When I looked back up, Rita was heading back towards the wagons. Not sure what to think, I wandered over to where Derek sat on the edge of a horse trough. He shaded his eyes against the evening sun with one hand as he looked up at me.
"On your way, then? I almost thought you might stick with us for a while."
I shook my head.
"Rita just gave me a jot," he nodded.
"I'm not terribly surprised. Most folks are nothing but dead weight," he shrugged. "And she appreciated your playing. Have you ever thought of trying out as a minstrel? They say Imre's a good place for it."
I steered the conversation back to Rita.
I don't want Rowan to be angry with her. He seems to take his money pretty seriously.
Derek laughed.
And she doesn't.
I gave my money to Rowan, I clarified. If he'd wanted to give some of it back, I think he'd do it himself.
Derek nodded.
It's not their way. A man doesn't give money away.
That's my point, I said. I don't want her to get in trouble. Derek waved his hands back and forth, cutting me off.
I'm not doing a good job explaining myself, he said. Rowan knows. He might have even sent her over to do it, but grown Caelish men don't give away money. It's seen as womanish behaviour. They don't even buy things if they can help it. Didn't you notice that Rita was the one who bargained for our rooms and food at the inn a few nights ago?
I did remember, now that he mentioned it. But why? I asked. Derek shrugged.
There isn't any why. It's just the way they do things. That's why so many Caelish caravans are husband-wife teams.
Derek!
Rowan's voice came from behind the wagons. He sighed as he stood up.
Duty calls,
he said.
See you around.
I tucked the jot into my pocket and thought about what Derek had said. The truth was, my troop had never gone so far north as to make it into the Schald. It was unnerving to think I wasn't as world-wise as I'd thought. I slung my travel sack over my shoulder and looked around one last time, thinking that perhaps it would be best if I left without any troublesome goodbyes. Denner was nowhere to be seen. That settled it then. I turned to leave and found her standing behind me. She smiled a little awkwardly with her hands clasped behind her back. She was lovely as a flower and totally unconscious of it. I was suddenly short of breath and I forgot myself, my irritation, my hurt.
You're still going?
She asked. I nodded.
You could come to Annalyn with us, she suggested. They say the streets are paved with gold there. You could teach Jocelyn to play that lute he carries around.
She smiled.
I've asked him, and he said he wouldn't mind.
I considered it. For half a heartbeat, I almost threw my whole plan aside just to stay with her a little longer.
Don't look like that,
she chided me with a smile.
I'll be there for a while, if things don't work out for you here.
She trailed off hopefully. I didn't know what I could do if things didn't work out for me here. I was hanging all my hopes on the university. Besides, Annalyn was hundreds of miles away. I barely owned the clothes on my back. How would I find her? Denna must have seen my thoughts reflected on my face. She smiled playfully.
I guess I'll just have to come looking for you then.
We Rue are travellers. Our lives are composed of meetings and partings with brief, bright acquaintances in between. Because of this, I knew the truth. I felt it, heavy and certain in the pit of my stomach. I would never see her again. Before I could say anything, she looked nervously behind her.
I'd better go. Watch for me.
She flashed her impish smile again before turning to walk away. I will, I called after her.
I'll see you where the roads meet.
She glanced back and hesitated for a moment, then waved and ran off into the early evening twilight. Chapter 36 Less Talents. I spent the night sleeping outside the city limits of Imre in a soft bed of heather. The next day, I woke late, washed in a nearby stream, and made my way west to the university. As I walked, I watched the horizon for the largest building in the university. From Ben's descriptions, I knew what it would look like. Featureless, grey, and square as a block. Larger than four granaries stacked together, no windows, no decorations, and only one set of great stone doors, 10 times 10,000 books. The archives,
I had come to the university for many reasons, but that was at the heart of it. The archives held answers, and I had many, many questions. First and foremost, I wanted to know the truth about the Chandrian and the Amir. I needed to know how much of Scarpi's story was the truth. When the road crossed the Omethi River, there was an old stone bridge. I don't doubt that you know the type. It was one of those ancient mammoth pieces of architecture scattered throughout the world, so old and solidly built that they have become part of the landscape, not a soul wondering who built them or why. This one was particularly impressive, over 200 feet long and wide enough for 2 wagons to pass each other. It stretched over the canyon the Omethi had carved into the rock. When I reached the crest of the bridge, I saw the archives for the first time in my life, rising like some great grey stone over the trees to the west. The university lay at the heart of a small city, though truthfully, I hesitate to call it a city at all. It was nothing like Tarbin with its twisting alleys and garbage smell. It was more of a town with wide roads and clean air. Lawns and gardens were spaced between small houses and shops. But since this town had grown up to serve the peculiar needs of the university, a careful observer could note small differences in the services the town provided. For instance, there were 2 glassblowers, 3 fully stocked apothecaries, 2 binderies, 4 booksellers, 2 brothels, and a truly disproportionate number of taverns. One of them had a large wooden sign nailed to its door proclaiming, "No sympathy." I wondered what non-arcane visitors might think of the warning. The university itself consisted of about 15 buildings that bore little resemblance to each other. Mews had a circular central hub with 8 wings radiating in each direction, so it looked like a compass rose. Hollows was simple and square with stained glass windows showing Tekum in a classic pose, standing barefoot in the mouth of his cave, speaking to a group of students. Mains was the most distinctive building of the lot. It covered nearly 1.5 acres and looked like it had been cobbled together from a number of smaller mismatched buildings. As I approached the archives, its grey, windowless surface reminded me of an immense grey stone. It was hard to believe after all the years of waiting that I was finally there. I circled around it until I found the entrance, a massive pair of stone doors standing wide open. Over them, chiseled deep into the stone, were the words, "Vorfelan Rinata Morie." I didn't recognize the language. It wasn't Siaru, maybe Ilish or Temik, yet another question I needed answers for. Through the stone doors was a small antechamber with a more ordinary set of wooden doors inside. I tugged them open and felt cool, dry air brush past me. The walls were bare grey stone, lit with the distinctive, unwavering reddish light of sympathy lamps. There was a large wooden desk with several large ledger-type books lying open atop it. At the desk sat a young man, who looked to be a full-blooded Kaeld, with the characteristic ruddy complexion and dark hair and eyes.
"Can I help ye?"
he asked, his young voice thick with the harsh burr a Siaru accent makes.
"I'm here for the archives,"
I said stupidly. My stomach was dancing with butterflies. My palms were sweaty. He looked me over, obviously wondering at my age.
"Are you a student?"
"Soon," I said. "I haven't been through admissions yet."
"You'll need to do that first," he said seriously. "I can't let anyone in unless they're in the book."
He gestured at the ledgers on the desk in front of him. The butterflies died. I didn't bother to hide my disappointment.
"Are you sure I can't look around for a couple of minutes? I've come an awfully long way."
I looked at the 2 sets of double doors leading out of the room, one labeled Tomes, the other Stacks. Behind the desk, a smaller door was labeled Scrivs Only. His expression softened somewhat.
"I cannot. There would be trouble."
He looked me over again. Are you really going through admissions? His scepticism was obvious even through his thick accent. I nodded. I just came here first, I said, looking around the empty room, eyeing the closed doors, trying to think of some way to persuade him to let me in. He spoke before I could think of anything. If you're really going, you should hurry. Today is the last day. Sometimes they don't go much longer than noon. My heart beat hard and quick in my chest. I'd assumed they would run all day. Where are they?
Hollows.
He gestured toward the outer door.
Down, then left. Short building with colour windows. Two big trees out front.
He paused.
Maple? Is that the word for a tree?
I nodded and hurried outside. Soon I was pelting down the road. 2 hours later I was in Hollows, fighting down a sour stomach and climbing up onto the stage of an empty theatre. The room was dark, except for the wide circle of light that held the master's table. I walked to stand at the edge of the light and waited. Slowly the 9 masters stopped talking among themselves and turned to look at me. They sat at a huge, crescent-shaped table. It was raised, so even seated they were looking down on me. They were serious-looking men, ranging in age from mature to ancient. There was a long moment of silence before the man sitting at the center of the crescent motioned me forward. I guessed he was the Chancellor.
Come up where we can see you. That's right. Hello. Now what's your name, boy?
Close, sir.
And why are you here?
I looked him in the eye.
I want to attend the university. I want to be an arcanist.
I looked around at each of them. Some seemed amused. None looked particularly surprised.
You are aware, the Chancellor said, that the university is for continuing one's education, not beginning it?
Yes, Chancellor, I know.
Very well, he said. May I have your letter of introduction?
I didn't hesitate.
I'm afraid I don't have one, sir. Is it absolutely necessary?
It is customary to have a sponsor, he explained. Preferably an arcanist. Their letter tells us what you know, your areas of excellence and weakness.
The arcanist I learned from was named Abenthi, sir, but he never gave me a letter of introduction. Might I tell you myself?
The Chancellor nodded gravely.
Unfortunately, we have no way of knowing that you actually have studied with an arcanist without proof of some kind. Do you have anything that can corroborate your story? Any other correspondence?
He gave me a book before we parted ways, sir. He inscribed it to me and signed his name.
The Chancellor smiled.
That should do nicely. Do you have it with you?
No.
I let some honest bitterness creep into my voice.
I had to pawn it in Tarbin.
Sitting to the left of the Chancellor, Master Rhetorician Hemme made a disgusted noise at my comment, earning him an irritated look from the Chancellor.
Come, Hemme, Hemme said, slapping his hand on the table. The boy is obviously lying. I have important matters to attend to this afternoon.
The Chancellor gave him a vastly irritated look.
I have not given you leave to speak, Master Hemme.
The two of them stared at each other for a long moment before Hemme looked away, scowling. The Chancellor turned back to me. Then his eye caught some movement from one of the other masters.
Yes, Master Loren.
The tall, thin master looked at me passively.
What was the book called?
Rhetoric and Logic, sir.
And where did you pawn it?
The broken binding on Seaward Square.
Loren turned to look at the Chancellor.
I will be leaving for Tarbin tomorrow to fetch necessary materials for the upcoming term. If it is there, I will bring it back. The matter of the boy's claim can be settled then.
The Chancellor gave a small nod.
Thank you, Master Loren.
He settled himself back into his chair and folded his hands in front of himself.
Very well, then. What would Abenthy's letter tell us if he had written it?
I took a good breath. He would say that I knew by heart the first 90 sympathetic bindings, that I could double distill, perform titration, calcify, sublimate, and precipitate solution, that I'm well versed in history, argument, grammars, medicine, and geometry. The Chancellor did his best to not look amused.
That's quite a list. Are you sure you didn't leave anything out?
I paused. He probably would have also mentioned my age, sir.
How old are you, boy?
Quoth, sir.
A smile tugged at the Chancellor's face.
Quoth.
15, sir.
There was a rustle as the masters each took some small action, exchanged glances, raised eyebrows, shook their heads. Heme rolled his eyes skyward. Only the Chancellor did nothing.
How exactly would he have mentioned your age?
I gave a thin sliver of a smile. He would have urged you to ignore it.
There was a breath of silence. The Chancellor drew a deep breath and leaned back in his seat.
Very well. We have a few questions for you. Would you like to begin, Master Brandier?
He made a gesture toward one end of the crescent table. I turned to face Brandier. Portly and balding, he was the university's master arithmetician.
How many grains are in 13 ounces?
6,240,
I said immediately.
He raised his eyebrows a little.
If I had 50 silver talents and converted them to vintage coin and back, how much would I have if the Kildim took 4% each time?
I started the ponderous conversion between currencies, then smiled as I realized it was unnecessary.
46 talents and 8 drabs, if he's honest. 46 even, if he's not.
He nodded again, looking at me more closely.
You have a triangle,
he said slowly.
One side is 7 feet, another side 3 feet. One angle is 60 degrees. How long is the other side?
Is the angle between the two sides?
He nodded. I closed my eyes for the space of half a breath, then opened them again.
6 feet 6 inches, dead even.
He made a humph noise and looked surprised.
Good enough, Master Arwill.
Arwill asked his question before I had time to turn and to face him.
What are the medicinal properties of hellebore?
Anti-inflammatory, antiseptic, mild sedative, mild analgesic, blood purifier, I said, looking up at the grandfatherly spectacled old man. Toxic if used excessively, dangerous for women who are with child.
Name the component structures that comprise the hand.
I named all 27 bones alphabetically, then the muscles from largest to smallest. I listed them quickly, matter-of-factly, pointing out their locations on my own upraised hand. The speed and accuracy of my answers impressed them. Some of them hid it, others wore it openly on their faces. The truth was, I needed to impress them. I knew from my previous discussions with Ben that you needed money or brains to get into the university. The more of one you had, the less of the other you needed. So, I was cheating. I had snuck into Hollows through a back entrance, acting the part of an errand boy. Then I'd picked 2 locks and spent more than an hour watching other students' interviews. I heard hundreds of questions and thousands of answers. I also heard how high the other students' tuitions were set. The lowest had been 4 talents and 6 jots, but most were double that. One student had been charged over 30 talents for his tuition. It would be easier for me to get a piece of the moon than that much money. I had 2 copper jots in my pocket and no way to get a bent penny more, so I needed to impress them. More than that, I needed to confound them with my intelligence, to dazzle them. I finished listing the muscles of the hand and started in on the ligatures when Arwill waved me into silence and asked his next question.
When do you bleed a patient?
The question brought me up short.
When I want him to die?
I asked dubiously. He nodded, mostly to himself.
Master Lauren?
Master Lauren was pale and seemed unnaturally tall even while sitting.
Who was the first declared king of Tarvintas?
Posthumously? Feder Calanthus. Otherwise it would be his brother Jarvis.
Why did the Aturan Empire collapse?
I paused, taken aback by the scope of the question. None of the other students had been asked anything so broad as this. Well, sir, I said slowly to give myself a moment or two to organize my thoughts, partly because Lord Nalto was an inept egomaniac, partly because the church went into upheaval and denounced the Order Amir, who were a large part of the strength of Atur, partly because the military was fighting three different wars of conquest at the same time, and high taxes fermented rebellion in lands already inside the Empire. I watched the Master's expression, hoping he would give some sign when he had heard enough. They also debased their currency, undercut the universality of the Iron Law, and antagonized the Ardem. I shrugged. But of course, it's more complicated than that. Master Lauren's expression remained unchanged, but he nodded.
Who was the greatest man who ever lived?
Another unfamiliar question. I thought for a minute. Ilion! Master Lauren blinked once, expressionless.
Master Mandrag?
Mandrag was clean-shaven and smooth-faced, with hands stained a half-hundred different colours, and seemed to be made all of knuckle and bone.
If you needed phosphorus, where would you get it?
His tone sounded for a moment so much like Abenthi's that I forgot myself and spoke without thinking. An apothecary? One of the masters on the other side of the table chuckled, and I bit my too quick tongue. He gave me a faint smile, and I drew a faint breath.
Barring access to an apothecary.
I could render it from urine, I said quickly, given a kiln and enough time.
How much would you need to gain 2 ounces pure?
He cracked his knuckles absent-mindedly. I paused to consider, as this was a new question too. At least 40 gallons, Master Mandrag, depending on the quality of the material. There was a long pause as he cracked his knuckles one at a time.
What are the 3 most important rules of the chemist?
This I knew from Ben. Label clearly, measure twice, eat elsewhere. He nodded, still wearing the faint smile.
Master Kilvin?
Kilvin was Kaeldish. His thick shoulders and bristling black beard reminded me of a bear.
Right,
he grumbled, folding his thick hands in front of him.
How would you make an ever-burning lamp?
Each of the other 8 masters made some sort of exasperated noise or gesture.
What?
Kilvin demanded, looking around at them, irritated.
It is my question. The asking is mine.
He turned his attention back to me.
So? How would you make it?
Well, I said slowly, I would probably start with a pendulum of some sort. Then I would bind it to...
Krim! No! Not like this!
Kilvin growled out a couple of words and pounded his fist on the table. Each thump as his hand came down was accompanied by a staccato burst of reddish light that welled up from his hand.
No sympathy! I do not want an ever-glowing lamp, I want an ever-burning one!
He looked at me again, showing his teeth, as if he were going to eat me.
Lithium salt?
I asked without thinking, then backpedaled.
No, a sodium oil that burned in an enclosed... Oh, no, damn!
I mumbled my way to a stop. The other applicants hadn't had to deal with questions like these. He cut me off with a short sideways gesture of his hand.
Enough! We will talk later.
Elksadal.
It took me a moment to remember that Elksadal was the next master. I turned to him. He looked like the archetypal sinister magician that seems to be a requirement in so many bad Turan plays. Severe dark eyes, lean face, short black beard. For all that is expressed.